Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Another awful day in Iraq with mass kidnappings and no doubt killings to follow. And pressure grows on Washington to do something to change course. Now, Tony Blair says, talk to the neighbors. Former Secretary of State James Baker has indicated he may say the same. Secretary of Defense in waiting, Robert Gates, has already said engage. But the neighbors that matter most in the Iraq War, Iran and Syria, are hardly the sugar-sharing kind with the United States. This is Axis of Evil territory, the realm of new nukes, territory neocons have wanted to invade. Critics say a talk remedy is an illusion, but the U.S. now has few choices and almost all are bad. Up next, On Point, meet the neighbors to the Iraq War. Joining me first today from Washington for the latest on the Iraq Study Group and Tony Blair's advice is Robin Wright. She's diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Robin, thank you very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
Tony Blair talking today with the Iraq Study Group. Do we know what's on his agenda? What's he want them to hear?
Well, the British Prime Minister has made clear that he supports outreach to particularly Syria and Iran. This is a position that has also been reflected among some of the Commission's own members, and so it's likely to get a strong endorsement today in that conversation.
Was there any indication in President Bush's response to his meeting, his preliminary briefing with the Iraq Study Group yesterday, that he is softening on the notion of talking to the neighbors, to Iran and Syria in particular?
No. The fact is that the administration has made clear it has been willing to talk to both Tehran and Damascus, but it has been discouraged by the response, by the conditions placed on a dialogue, by the environment in which it is happening, the broader environment in Iran's case, with the nuclear issue developing on the as one of the great next challenges for the United States.
Jim Baker, Secretary of State, Jim Baker, former, has been out to the region. He's been to Syria and talked with them. Tony Blair, presumably, has a lot of people looking closely at this region. What did they see that President Bush, maybe Vice President Cheney, Security Advisor Stephen Hadley, do not?
Well, the interesting thing about this commission is that it's having a series of conversations. It's not a grilling of any of the participants or any of the experts. It's really trying to explore what has happened, what priorities are. And an important thing to remember about this commission is that it is looking not just at the issue of Iraq. It's looking at the broader question of U.S. interests. And that includes things like energy and Middle East peace and all the issues that spill over or overlap with Iraq. So this is a much broader mandate, which is why it's interesting that the outreach has been so extensive.
Both Tony Blair and Jim Baker, in informal conversations, have talked about some kind of what can sound like a grand bargain here that goes even beyond the neighbors to include Israel and the Palestinians. When you say larger American interests, is there any indication that the Iraq Study Group is going to put forward some kind of region-wide super, you know, solution, once-and-for-all kind of program here?
Certainly that's one of the options, but I think we all have to be cautious. There's been an awful lot of speculation about what this commission is likely to say, and I think they have not yet reached the point that they know themselves. Remember, there are five Democrats, five Republicans, and they have to come up with some kind of joint consensus. I suspect it will be rather centrist. And perhaps the biggest looming question is whether it will look at whether the road to peace in Baghdad is through Jerusalem. That is something that Jim Baker particularly feels strongly about. He, in the aftermath of the previous Gulf War, had organized the Madrid conference that brought together all the parties to try to move on the peace process. It's very premature to draw any conclusions about what they're likely to do. We'll know probably within a month, And it is one option, but it's not the only option.
And Robin, finally, what have you heard after the conversations yesterday, these preliminary conversations of the Iraq Study Group representatives and a lot of the core security team of the Bush administration? What's coming out of the White House? Are they encouraged by the work being done here? Are they nervous about it? Is a meeting of the minds guaranteed to take place because Jim Baker's a Bush family friend at the top of this thing? Or could we end up at loggerheads between the White House and the study group?
Not necessarily loggerheads, but I do think that one of the interesting questions is whether the group can come up with a lot of proposals that sound good in principle, that sound like they might be a way out. But when it comes to the issue of implementation, on the issues, for example, of dealing with Iran and Iraq, mm-hmm. what happens when you actually sit down at that table and the Syrians and the Iranians make their own demands? And it's ever more difficult for the administration to give ground because of the nuclear issue, which looms over any kind of dialogue.
Potential demands for Tehran, such as potentially we might help you if you accept our nuclear program.
Right. I mean, it's not just a simple let's talk about Iraq. There are other issues that shade the relationship. So, yes, I think the administration is hopeful that the Baker Commission will set a new framework for action, provide a context for the administration to shift that is acceptable to the American people. It won't look like it's giving in or it's admitted failure. But the question is what happens when it actually comes to implementation? There are some who argue in Washington that the Baker-Hamilton Commission is actually just a first step, that this will trigger debate about what's viable, what can be done. It'll lead to some initial overtures, but it may not be the final formulation.
Robin Wright, diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Robin, it's always great to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
We are looking in this hour at the neighbors to the Iraq War and their interests in war and peace. Joining me now in that effort from Washington is Barbara Bodine, former ambassador to Yemen and for some 34 years a diplomat focused on the Middle East. She was posted to Baghdad during the years of the Iran-Iraq War. In 2003, she served as coordinator for post-conflict reconstruction in Baghdad. She's currently a visiting scholar at MIT's Center for International Studies. Ambassador Bodine, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Also with us from Monterey, California, is Vali Nasser, professor of national security affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School and author of the much-admired new book, The Shia Revival, How Conflicts Within Islam Will Shape the Future. Vali Nasser, thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Barbara Bodine, Ambassador Bodine, first to you, just top level, what do you make of the call from Tony Blair, very strong in the last 24, 48 hours, to get the neighbors involved here, Iran and Syria in particular? Is that a hopeful path in your view?
I think it's probably coming down to one of the few paths that we have left. Since it does come from Tony Blair, to borrow one of his predecessors' phrases from Churchill, Americans have a tendency to do the right thing, but only after we have exhausted every other option. And I think that Blair is looking at our Iraq policy to date and our efforts to date and believes that at this point we have exhausted all other options. We have tried to work the Iraq issue, if you like, from the inside out and trying to do it from a security question first before you get to the political. And what Blair is saying is that it's really time to, if not reverse that, at least balance it by working on the outside coming in and on more of a political and a diplomatic level. We really don't have very many other options at this point.
Vali Nasser, that's not exactly a heartening view here. In a way, post-election, the scales fall from our eyes and we see a lot of bad options. So is talking to the neighbors, is it a real option towards some kind of solution or a more secure position, or is it a kind of, pass the hot potato, punt and run, not cut and run?
Well, it could be both. It can provide, as Ambassador Bodine says, our only option to credibly and realistically extricate ourselves from Iraq in a manner that doesn't leave problems behind. That would have us go back there in the near future. In many ways, the political roadmap for Iraq, which was based on the idea of a national unity government, is now dead. Even the Iraqi prime minister is asking for the cabinet that was based on national unity government to be scuttled and for a new political setup to be brought about in Baghdad. It is clear that we cannot impose a security situation on Iraq. We cannot fight the insurgency and also police the sectarian violence in order to be able to scale down, to extricate ourselves from Iraq. We need a new credible political process that would bring about at least a viable government that gives us a fig leaf to come out of Iraq. And for that, we need the buy-in of Iraq's neighbors. It's very clear that the United States by itself cannot lead a political process in Iraq. We cannot bring the various sides to make necessary compromises. They trust the neighbors. It's not just that they're getting security funding from the neighbors or getting money and weapons, but there's a certain degree of trust and relationship with various neighbors, and we need to leverage those relationships in a manner that would create a sustainable government in Baghdad.
We're getting a lot of rough news here today. I mean, this mass kidnapping right out of the Ministry of Higher Education in the middle of Baghdad, 100-plus people, and these are, you know, this is right out of the heart of the Iraqi government, kidnapped and taken away, very likely to end up dead. More news, Vali Nasr saying, Vali Nasr, if I understood you correctly, the U.S. cannot fix the security situation, cannot fix the political situation. If then we're almost dependent on the neighbors, whether we like it or not, let me ask each of you, Ambassador Bodine, starting with you, how do you see Iran's interests in the outcome of the Iraq war? What are they? How does Iran see them?
I think Iran's interests on one macro level are really in many ways not that different than ours, which is, as I said, a stable, non-threatening Iraq. Iran is not going to be served, and they know they won't be served, if Iraq becomes a failed state, if this level of anarchy and violence continues. And so in that sense, we are looking for a common goal. Even the question about whether or not it is Shia-dominated or secular is secondary to having to avoiding having a failed state. Iran has never advocated, and I don't believe it, they see it in their interest, for Iraq to be dismembered either. In that case, even if you ended up with a friendly Shia state in the south, you have at least one failed state in the middle, which would be the Sunni remnants, and Kurdistan, which has its own political agenda. So the dismemberment, the anarchy, the chaos, this is not in Iran's interest. I think it's also important to keep in mind that while Iran has considerable national interest there, and I think we have to remember that they did go through an 8-year war with the Iraqis, their influence is considerable, but they are not in a position to dictate. At the end of the day, their co-religious on the other side of the border are and see themselves as Iraqis and Arabs while they are still Shia, and they do see the Iranians as not Arab. So I think we need to bring them in and recognize what they can do to assist, but I think we also have to be realistic about even the limits of their influence at this point.
Vali Nasr, how do you see Iran's interest as the number one neighbor in this question? Barbara Bodine says they have a common goal, but do they really? I mean, Iran is working on a nuclear program. It would appear want nuclear weapons. That doesn't seem to be a common goal. There's been a lot of conversation that they want to have a theocracy in Iraq that would be kind of in their camp as part of Iranian hegemony. That doesn't sound like a common goal with the United States. How do you see it? Are they opposed to a failed state? Do they see common goals with the U.S. here?
Well, all of these assertions to some extent are true. First of all, Iran is the only country in the region that from the very beginning supported and had an interest in U.S.'s political process in Iraq. It is ironic that Iran and U.S. alone have been supporting this UIA government in the region, that Iran is also very committed to the success of the current government in Iraq. It encouraged the Iraqi Shias to participate in the elections. It played a role in brokering deals between Iraqi Shias and Kurds in putting together the governments that have been in power.
But the Maliki government appears to be falling apart. Is that a demonstration of the limits of Iran's power if they're so supportive?
Well, they supporting is different from being able to make a government viable. Maliki's government is falling apart partly because the constitution in Iraq places undue burden on governance. You have to maintain a two-thirds majority in order to be able to hold the government together. And then since last year, there's been a lot of pressure to rule by a national consensus, which goes even beyond the 75% mandate in the parliament. The government is falling apart. The UIA government is the UIA coalition is not falling apart. That's the Shia coalition. The alliance with the Sunnis outside of that coalition, which has been the basis of the government, is falling apart. But I fully agree with Barbara that Iran does not want to see Iraq fail. Civil war or disintegration of Iraq will complicate Iran's life immensely. It will be very expensive for Iran to micromanage or have to subsidize or fight for its clients within Iraq. It can also worsen Iran's relations with Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, and make it much more difficult for Iran to assert its own position in the region.
Let me ask you, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president, saying just across the wire, saying that Iran will talk with the U.S. if the U.S. corrects its behavior. I'm not sure what that means exactly, but would Iran be, are we at the kind of end of the road here of this phase, or would Iran be happy to see the U.S. bleed and be diminished in stature for, I don't know, another year, another $100-200 billion, more lives than all the rest in Iraq? Or do you think it's that Tehran is thinking it's time to do something here, Valiant?
Well, there are two issues for Iran. One is indeed to make the U.S. bleed. From the very beginning, the Iranians had an interest in stability in Iraq, but they did not want the kind of bullish attitude that took U.S. into Iraq to succeed so that then the United States would feel confident on taking Iran on. Iran followed a policy of controlled chaos. They didn't want total chaos in Iraq, but they didn't want the United States to come out confident from Iraq. The Iranians are looking at Iraq at two levels. One is, what does it mean for U.S. power and therefore for the U.S. bargaining position vis-a-vis Iran? And for that reason, you're right, they may calculate that they can wait. But then they have their own assessment of the situation on the ground in Iraq. And in some ways, their assessment is just as good or even better than the U.S. They have a lot of intelligence on the ground. And they may be also calculating that it's now end of the road and it's time to save Iraq from things that are far worse. And what you're quoting, Ahmadinejad, this is sort of this is all posturing, just like Tony Blair suggests that it's time to talk to Iran, provided that Iran behaves. The Iranians are responding. But the far more important thing is several months ago, the Iranian Supreme Leader in a Friday prayers for the first time since the Iranian Revolution openly said that Iran should talk to the United States about Iraq. And that verdict is still on the table. So Iran, in principle, has already accepted talking to the U.S. About Iraq.
Ambassador Bodine Valinasser, I want to begin to bring our listeners in from Van Horn, Iowa. Tom's calling. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a question or a comment about talking with Syria directly. Now, it's the lady that's on before, Robin
Wright of the Washington Post, or Barbara
right.
Bodine, ambassador, yeah.
She said that George Bush had said that Syria is our enemy, but it also came out that our CIA was arresting people or kidnapping them or whatever you want to call it and sending them with the extreme rendition to Syria to be tortured.
Right, so it's a dappled relationship here, yeah.
So somebody from America knows people in Syria and they're talking to them directly. Why doesn't Bush ask those guys to go talk to Syrians, like the CIA or whoever is doing that?
Tom, let us pick it up. Barbara Bodine, where do you see conversations with Syria and Iran staying at this point? Have we already had back-channel conversations, both, either?
Well, certainly with Syria, we continue to have an embassy in Damascus. We don't have an ambassador there. She was pulled out maybe 2 years ago at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But we do still have an embassy. And we also have other channels for talking with the Syrians, the UN, and places like that. So the channels are there. The people are there. And there is certainly some dialogue. What we're really talking about here is a more formal reaching out to the Syrians and bringing them in, at least on the issue of Iraq, as something of a partner. When you will recall last summer when there was the conflict between Hezbollah and Israel, we refused to talk to the Syrians in any formal way. And our position was they know what to do. Well, that may or may not be correct. You do need to bring people in. You do need to start talking to them. We do have these informal channels which can help us lay the groundwork for a regional effort. We won't be starting from zero, and that is, in fact, the good news. With Tehran, we have isolated ourselves, and they have isolated them from us.
Since 1979, essentially.
1979. What really has developed, though, over the intervening decades is that the rest of the world continues to deal with Iran, including most of our very good friends. And we have, in many ways, isolated ourselves from Iran, and we don't have those channels. On Ahmadinejad's comment, I would agree that this is it has to be seen as part of a pre-negotiation posturing. And I think it's also very important to understand that the Iranian government has multiple power centers. And we need to recognize the complexity of the Iranian government and start to deal with that in a way that is constructive for us and for Iraq.
You're talking about the power extending to Damascus and Lebanon and Hezbollah and Hamas and right on. Vali Nasser, let me put to you, I mean, the critics of this say, look, this clearly the White House is looking for some face-saving here. Maybe James Baker can help them. But this can easily look like kind of a joke. I mean, if you look at Syria's role in Lebanon, that has been anything but that of a positive referee in that conflict. Iran wants nuclear weapons and has talked about getting rid of Israel, has set itself in opposition to American goals very publicly. I mean, is this just a case where the administration has stepped in it so deep that they may present this as a solution, but in fact it's handing Iraq off to an agenda that's not in line with America's at all?
Well, that might end up being the case, but it is a choice. The alternative is also not very palatable. In other words, if the U.S. is not engaging the neighbors, particularly Syria and Iran, which have not only vested interests but a lot of say already in Iraq's affairs, then it has to be prepared to stay facing the current situation or worsening situation for the foreseeable future. Now, it seems that both the will of the American people and the political momentum in Washington is that the current situation is intolerable. So we have to look at an alternative. Now, ironically, Iraq is the place where relations between Syria and the U.S., and particularly relations between Iran and the U.S., can actually move in a positive direction. Because in Lebanon, U.S. and Iran are just too far apart to even talk. Mm. On the nuclear issue, you have a stalemate. The war of words between the two sides have been fairly strong. Ironically, in Iraq, there is actually at least a basis for an agreement. And the basis is the following, that neither the United States nor Iran wants Iraq to break apart. Neither the United States or Iran want Iraq to end up in civil war. Beyond this, they have no agreement about a path forward. But at least in terms of how do you prevent Iraq from either ending up in civil war or breaking up, there is room for them to engage and to have a rules of the game that would allow them to work at least towards that end.
But how do you hold hands over Iraq while in the UN Security Council, the U.S. is pushing very hard for sanctions against Iran at the very same time on its nuclear program? Is Iran going to say, all right, we'll help you, but you have to sit still while we become a nuclear power?
Well, I don't agree with this because most of the observers assume that Iran would be doing the United States a favor if it dealt with the U.S. on Iraq. Mm-hmm. Iran, as Barbara has also mentioned mm-hmm. amply at the beginning, has its own interests in Iraq, which are at the moment the same interests as the United States. Namely, they don't want the failed Iraq and they want the Shiites in Iraq to succeed and they want the Kurds to stay within Iraq. And therefore, Iran would be serving itself also by cooperating mm-hmm. with the U.S.
So there may
now,
be a way to play.
If they end up being mm-hmm. successful, mm-hmm. if there is this, there is success here, then there might be actually an opening to then extend the discussions to Lebanon and the nuclear issue. I think the Iraq issue should not be a hostage to the nuclear issue. It should be an opportunity to actually do better on the nuclear issue if you can do well here.
There's an optimistic opportunity. Ambassador Bodine, stand by for just a second. I want to hear you on that, but we've got so many listeners calling in. Hamid is calling from Bedford, Massachusetts. Hamid, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm from Iran myself, and I'd just like to make a comment. I'm not sure what kind of policy or I don't know how you would call it, that you'd need the help of another country, and at the same time you're threatening them. I mean, it's not going to work.
This was Tony Blair even yesterday saying, we want to talk to Iran and Syria, but we're going to be tough on them about their agenda, their policies.
Is it just the way to show that I'm a tough guy before I ask for your help? Or it doesn't work. I've been talking to my families and friends back home, and the views are totally different. The only way I can see a solution to this is to both sides actually put down their arrogance and sit down and talk about their mutual interests.
It sounds like a tall order, but the stakes are getting high here. Let's listen for just a second to the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, talking yesterday in London, saying the West might be willing to talk about everything, but there's a carrot and stick here.
We offer Iran a clear strategic choice. They help the Middle East peace process, not hinder it. They stop supporting terrorism in Lebanon or Iraq. They abide by, not flout, their international obligations. In that case, a new partnership is possible. Or alternatively, they face the consequence of not doing so, isolation.
Ambassador Bodine, that's not a narrow conversation focused just on Iraq. That's the whole thing, the Middle East peace process, terrorism generally, international obligations. That sounds like the grand bargain language.
It is the grand bargain language, and I think as a long-term goal, it's also quite reasonable. I mean, as Blair said, if Iran wants to have a broader international partnership, it needs to be constructive on the peace process and abide by its obligations. And that's kind of the long-term goal.
Everybody waiting for the final report out of the Iraq Study Group. James Baker, former Secretary of State, sat down with us just last month and told us why he believes that talking, even to avowed enemies, is the way to success on the world stage.
I believe that you talk not just to your friends, but also to your enemies. And I went to Syria 15 times back in 1991 when they were a country that was on a list of countries that state-sponsored terrorism. And on the 16th trip, Syria changed 25 years of policy and came and sat at the negotiating table with Israel, thereby implicitly recognizing Israel's right to exist. Had we not been willing to engage in that diplomacy and talk to the Syrians at that time, we never would have gotten that breakthrough. You never would have had a Madrid peace conference, and you never would have had, in my opinion, peace between Israel and Jordan today.
Former Secretary of State James Baker laying out how he sees talking with even enemies in a conversation with us last month. Let's go to Pat in Buffalo, New York. Pat, what do you hear? What do you think?
Right. Hi, Tom. My take on this is that, first place, the Bush policy team for foreign policy is very immature. I mean, from Condoleezza Rice saying, you know, hey, they got to cut it out. And all their rhetoric seems to be stuff like that they're not mature enough to handle it.
Okay, but what do we do here, Pat?
Okay, as far as the Baker thing, you know, the Israel and Palestine is a non-starter. They wanted a free election. They got a Hezbollah. They didn't like that. Secondly, you know, Bush is going to stall this as far out as he can get it.
So you don't think they will talk to the neighbors, even if Jim Baker says to?
You know what? By the time it gets going, he'll be out of office.
Pat, thanks for that. Barbara Bodine, what about it? Vali Nasser is describing situation sort of, you know, the knife's edge right at the administration's throat in Iraq. Do you think the Bush White House now feels so under the gun that they're ready to make radical changes in their approach here or not?
I do. Part of it comes from the election that we just had. Whatever the roots of the Iraq Study Group were, it now does allow the president a face-saving way out of this mess to be able to look at alternatives that were on the table before and dismissed. Jim Baker makes a very good point that I think needs to be held in mind, is that this is going to be a long process, even if it is successful. Those who think that we're going to be able to have one or two conversations with the neighbors probably are looking at a diplomacy that is one of dictating, not one of working this through. It's going to take a very long time. I don't think that the American people or the Congress that that we are now going to have would really let the president sort of, you know, slow roll this.
But taking a long time sounds like slow rolling, or maybe
there's
no option.
Slow rolling, it's a question of whether you're slow rolling getting it started or slow rolling letting it develop.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that probably one of the things the administration would have to do, however, is appoint a special envoy, maybe even someone like Baker, who the parties to these talks would not see as overly identified with the previous policy, but something like the way that Gates has come in to signal a change in our military strategy.
And Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense in waiting, who was part of a Council on Foreign Relations report, I believe, over the summer, saying to engage. Mm-hmm. But we're on the record through our ambassador in Baghdad, Khalilzad, saying foreign rivals like Iran and Syria, the same two we're talking about here, are trying to tear the Iraqi people apart along sectarian lines. Stephen Hadley, National Security Advisor, saying last month talking isn't a strategy. You wonder how this is going to work out. Let's take a call from Washington. Riaz is on the line. Hi, Riaz. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you? My question to both Professor Bodine and Professor Vali Nasser, whom I know personally both, I'm really puzzled by our reluctance of dealing with these two countries. If we can establish kind of a program in advance, what are the benefits for these two countries to get from that engagement, and what are the downsides? Keeping in mind that President Talbani mentioned that almost 6-7 weeks ago, and we just ignored it.
In Iraq itself.
Yes, President Talbani of Iraq suggested from a long time ago, actually, more than 7 weeks ago, that we should encourage Syria and Iran to participate.
Riaz, let us pick that up. And Vali Nasser, I'll come first to you. Here's the idea that we should lay down the conditions. And this tone was deeply embedded in Tony Blair's comments yesterday, sort of say, here's how it's going to be. Here's the carrot. Here's the stick. Now you choose. Set the stage. Make the framework. Is the United States or the U.S. and the U.K. together, are they in any position to dictate anything here right now? Do we have enough carrots and sticks with Iran to make that work?
Within the context of Iraq, we cannot dictate. Dictating will not solve anything. We don't just need Iran and Syria to stop doing certain things, providing arms or allowing insurgents into Iraq. We also need them to do positive things. We need Iran to lean on the Shias to make compromises with the Sunnis. We also need to bring Saudi Arabia and Jordan formally into this. We also need them to lean on the Sunnis to make compromises, and we need to lean ourselves on the Kurds to make compromises.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have a positive engagement with Iran and Syria that is not just about you should stop doing this or I'm going to do this to you, but we should rather try to look at what their interests are and then get them positively engaged in the process. I think, you know, Tony Blair was talking much more about how Iran should think down the road it would like to live in the Middle East along with others and with the United States, as opposed to trying to talk about Iraq in particular.
Ambassador Bodine, let's look at the other neighbors for a second here. We have given them short shrift so far. What about the big ones, the Saudis in the south, the Turks in the north? Can they be helpful here? Have they stepped up so far? If not, why not? What could they do that they're not?
I do think it is kind of interesting that we have gone this far into the conversation and we haven't mentioned either the Turks or the Saudis, who have considerable borders and considerable interest in this.
No kidding.
And they do share the view that we have been talking about, that a failed Iraq is a major threat to them. The Turks do have a role to play, particularly on the northern border with the Kurds.
What can they do? How could they lead toward a solution, an exit, a strategy that would work here?
Well, I think part of that would be in how they work with the Kurds on their view on an independent Kurdistan, which they certainly don't want, but how they are willing to operate with a Kurdish semi-autonomous region? Is this something that they can signal that they're comfortable with and that they will work with?
Mm-hmm.
The Saudis, I agree with Vali, have some influence on the Sunni side. And
so where is it? Have they used it?
They haven't used it very much because part of it is a concern as to what kind of government is going to be showing up in Baghdad. And I think they have to have some sense that it is a little bit more balanced. They're certainly very concerned about too much of an Iranian influence. Where the Saudis did actually try to be positive and constructive in the very, very early days. They offered, for example, to work with the Iraqi army to help it transition into something a little less thuggish than it was under Saddam. And we didn't take them up on it. So there are some things they can do.
We disbanded the army. Do the Saudis fear civil war, regional meltdown, sort of flooding across their border into their oil fields, Ambassador Bodine?
It already has. I mean, there already has been an increase in, if you want, kind of jihadi-like violence in Saudi Arabia. They've gotten it back under control, but it has already slid over into Saudi Arabia, and it looks like it may slide into other parts of the Gulf. So it's not a potential problem. It's a very real problem for them.
And if it's Al-Qaeda in Iraq that's exercising a lot of this insurgency or some piece of it, do they really have influence with them? Those are enemies of the Saudi monarchy. Wali Nasser?
Well, I mean, first of all, I agree with everything Barbara said, but I think, and also to add to this, a lot of the money for particularly the Al-Qaeda element is coming from Persian Gulf sources. Saudi Arabia, as well as other Gulf countries, mm-hmm. can do a lot more to shut that off.
Mm.
But, you know, the Saudi case is very interesting when we think about Iran and Syria. Saudi Arabia, as Barbara mentioned, has enormous amount of interest in success of Iraq. But Saudis were very comfortable pledging $5 to $6 billion to the Lebanese government right after the civil war.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't given a dime to the Iraqi government, and their attitude is that the U.S. doesn't ask our opinion in making policy about Iraq; it just expects us to support mm-hmm. whatever Washington does.
But maybe they're smart not to give a dime. We've given many billions, and they've just gone up in flames. Until there's some stability there, who wants to pour money in?
They're willing to put money into Iraq, provided that their viewpoint is reflected mm-hmm. in the discussions. If you're not talking to people, whether they are allies or enemies, as Jim Baker mm-hmm. mentioned, you cannot expect their support, even if it is self-evident that they should be wanting a stable Iraq.
But are the Saudis prepared to accept a Shiite-dominated government, which is what a democracy, any kind of democracy, or just the weight of numbers is going to mean there? Or do they insist on Sunnis maintaining some of their historical privilege?
Well, there is going to be a bargain. I mean, one of the problems mm-hmm. is not that only the U.S. hasn't been talking to the neighbors, is that the neighbors are not talking to one another either. Just like, deals that were made in Lebanon or in the Taif Agreement or mm-hmm. deals that were made in other places, ultimately the Saudis and the Jordanians are not going to get everything they want. The Iranians are not going to get everything they want. The balance in the end in Iraq has to be somewhere in the middle, but we're not going to get to the middle until people begin talking. And until they arrive at an agreement that everybody's minimal expectations in Iraq are protected, and then they will be willing to support a solution that at least protects their minimal expectations.
Mm-hmm. So there's a note of hope, but it looks dark. Paul's calling from Pensacola, Florida. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. What a great segue when we're talking about the need to talk. If you're in a negotiation, if you have parties that are attempting to acquire, a bargain, you have to communicate. And the idea of saving face at this point and saying, well, we'll only talk if you do this, is ridiculous. It's basically it's putting preconditions that cannot be met. And so,
So what are you saying? Just give it to Iran and walk away?
No, of course not.
Mm-hmm.
Of course not. I'm saying we need to talk. We need to. I mean, if you have people that are, let's just put this down in human terms,
mm-hmm.
as relationships between two people. If they get angry with each other and then they don't talk, well, there's no progress, and what that results in is people becoming estranged and never accomplishing anything.
Well, we see that. Maybe don't come in too bossy is the word here when you're in our circumstances. All right. Let's take a call from Lexington, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air.
My question is to the gentleman from Iran about the Khomeini doctrine, which is to me seems really, as far as dealing with Iran, is the biggest problem right now. And to me, it's actually the elephant in the room that's not even been mentioned.
Define it, the Khomeini doctrine.
Khomeini doctrine pretty much states that their goal is to destroy the Western world, and in any case, the way of life of the Western world, which Ahmadinejad subscribes to very fanatically. And this I can't call it any other thing than the elephant in the room, mm-hmm. has not even begun to be considered.
Let us pick that straight up, Joe. Thanks for your call. Vali Nasser, how about it? If Iran's Khomeini doctrine is destroy the Western world or way of life, how do you negotiate with that?
Well, I don't believe that actually that's the operating doctrine in Iran. I mean, this is the way that often Iran is depicted. The Iranians have strategic interest in the region. They want to be accepted as a hegemon in the Gulf. They want the United States to stop blocking that. But I don't believe that, you know, they are driven by sort of a global ambition to destroy the Western way of life. In fact, in most of the Muslim world, they don't care about Western values. They want the United States and the West to stop certain policies. This is mostly the rhetoric of post 9/11 that came from the U.S. in order to define the attitude of the Muslim world as if it's not about policies, it's about values. The battle is not about values, it's about policies. And in the case of Iraq, it's about very concrete things. Who wins Iraq? Who gets what in Iraq? Who gets to influence the future of Iraq? It has nothing to do with global values.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador Bodine, we've got a final caller, well, many, but one here saying, and I don't have time to go to Nelson in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, but saying, look, on Election Day, the voters spoke, and they said was, get out of Iraq, so why are we talking about the details here? Is talking to the neighbors, even if get out is the message, is talking necessary to get out, or might we just go?
Well, yeah, and that's a very good question. The question is really, how do we leave? We didn't actually go into Iraq with a great deal of planning, and we certainly didn't do the occupation with much planning at all. Bringing the neighbors in, I would say, is one of a required step in setting the conditions so that we can leave Iraq in something short of the last episode of MASH, where you just pack up and leave. That, first of all, that's not practical. And second of all, it would create a vortex there that would not be in the interest of many of our friends. We keep talking about our two enemies in the region, but we have the Turks and the Saudis and the Jordanians and others who are very good friends. And we have to think about what a vortex in Iraq would do to them. So I see this as part of that. This is how you do it. It's not a hot potato handoff, but it is a sharing. The issue of you know, why are we talking to our enemies? This is, if you think about North Korea, we've ended up working very closely with the Chinese on North Korea because we have a shared interest there.
And even shared interest really is going to have to be the last word today. Barbara Bodine, I'm afraid with that we're out of time. No last episode of MASH is here. We're grateful to you for your time. Thanks for joining us, Ambassador.
Sure.
And Vali Nasser in Monterey, California, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.